Blog Talk Radio.
Everybody, and welcome to another episode we have here of Crime and Science Radio, hosted, of course, by D.P. Lyle and Jan Burke. Today's show is called The Criminal Justice System, Real and Imagined, with very special guest, Alifair Burke. So now, without any further ado, here's your host, Doug Lyle and Jan Burke.
Welcome, everyone. We're glad you're joining us today on Crime and Science Radio. We're really pleased to have author Alifair Burke, who is a former prosecutor and currently a criminal law professor. She's going to talk to us about her experiences and some of the differences in legal realities and the perceptions we have of the U.S. criminal justice system. Welcome, Alifair.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Well, you're not only someone with a law degree from a very prestigious university and experience as a prosecutor, you're a law professor, but before you gathered all that legal expertise, you lived in Wichita, Kansas during a time when one of the most notorious serial killers in the United States was at large. So I thought it would be good for us to hear. I know you've mentioned in the past that you were affected by the BTK serial killer case growing up. Can you talk to us about that?
Yeah, sure. And, you know, to be clear, it's. I hate it when people say, like, oh, something really affected me. Like, everybody's like, 9/11, you know, people who had nothing to do with anything going on in the World Trade Center, like, it's so affecting to me. Okay, things affect you, of course, without affecting you the way they really affect victims. So I just want to make sure that, you know, I don't consider myself a victim of that. But everybody who grew up in Wichita, Kansas in the 1970s kind of grew up in this cloud of this weird juxtaposition of Kansas is a pretty provincial place. And, in fact, my family moved there from Southern Florida because my dad and my mom thought that Southern Florida was getting chaotic and it was kind of a hard place to raise four kids. And my dad found a job in Wichita, Kansas, and I think in his mind he was thinking, like, oh, this is a really good thing to do for my family. It's going to be like this safe provincial place where I can raise them. And we show up, and immediately the news announces that there's this serial killer who calls himself BTK, that stands for Bind, Torture, and Kill, which is not a good thing to hear. We were 8 years old, and it was this juxtaposition that in Kansas, it's part of the identity there, that, like, part of Kansas is, like, Kansas. It's plain, and it's safe, and it's proud of not being New York and not being California. And meanwhile, this extremely terrifying thing is going on where this guy is targeting women and in some cases children just at random. And I think it was a weird lesson early on that things aren't what they seem. Like, you can't just say, like, oh, I live in a good neighborhood, or I'm a good girl, or I live a safe life. That things are beyond your control. There are things that are deeply evil in the world that can find you, no matter how hard you try to avoid that. And I think there's that instinct, you know how when you're reading a story and you read any kind of horrible story, like a child dying or a woman's killed in her home, you immediately want to look for the reason, right? Like, oh, there's some other shady scenario that somehow this family brought that on themselves. And with the BTK killer, there was none of that. This wasn't risky lifestyle victims. There was nothing like that. He really did just pick people at random and go after them. And growing up in that environment where that not only happened, but happened repeatedly with no arrest and no resolution, was a strange way to grow up. It was like a weird little war zone. You know, I had a pretty normal life, but at the same time, we were told, every, and again, it's not just me, every kid who grew up there, you had a drill, basically. Like when you came home, you would check the phone line to make sure that the phone line worked, because he would cut the phone lines, and you would check the basement door, because people thought, it turned out to be mistakenly, but they thought he might be getting in through basements. So everybody had locks on their basement doors. So you would check the phone line, check the basement door, and then lock the door behind you. And that was just the drill, and I still find myself doing that now, you know, when I'm 44 years old. So and it, yeah. when we talk about writing, that at 8 years old, to be filled with those kinds of dark thoughts, and we always say that we write stories by saying, what if? It really was, mm-hmm. every time you check the phone line, you're thinking, what if? Every time you check the lock, you start thinking about, is he here and why? And I think that leads a child's imagination, especially when we were told, like, not to talk about it. It was this weird kind of thing,
right.
That your imagination just goes to crazy places.
Now, you're making me think of a couple things here. One is, I have a theory that one reason so many mysteries are set in Southern California is a similar kind of thing of, you know, paradise on the outside, sunny, you know,
right.
Glamorous, and underneath it all, there's this creepy underbelly. But the other thing that you just made me think of is when Richard Ramirez was the Night Stalker, as he was known here, was mm-hmm. This serial rapist and murderer, was on the loose in Southern California. And when you're talking about locking the basement doors, there was actually a decrease in burglaries during the time he was out. And
is
they
that
weren't
right?
Sure whether
everybody
it was because
was
people
so
were locking
watchful.
Up better or that burglars were pretty sure that people were just going to shoot first.
Right,
and ask
right.
questions
I might be mistaken for the Night Stalker. I better not break into someone's house. It's a strange
exactly.
kind of crime deterrent.
it was scary times around here. I know their last victims were right here in Mission Viejo, and the man who was shot before the woman was raped and all that and survived, he survived too. He was actually in the ICU of one of the hospitals that I worked at. We used to see him every day. So, I mean, it was a stark reminder, and we locked doors, and I had a loaded shotgun, and Nan had piled pots and pans against the doors, and I told her, I said, if a cat knocks the pans over, I'm going to shoot you. You know,
yeah, it's,
all that.
It's a weird thing because you start to, it's a rational fear of a boogeyman, basically,
yeah.
and it really did take, mm-hmm. it took me years to get over it, and I think working at the DA's office actually helped me in that sense because, you know, it took me years to realize that statistically the odds of something happening to you like that, you know, being randomly chosen in your house for some horrific crime is extremely low, but where I grew up, it wasn't so low.
Well, and of course, Kansas had been through that 20 years earlier with the
right.
Clutter family, you know, the famous In Cold Blood murders that Truman Capote wrote the wonderful book about. And that kind of shook Kansas. It shook the whole nation because, you know, the same thing. It's like the Manson family, people sleeping home in bed and bang, they're gone. And so random and so violent and it's interesting that, you know, that you had that childhood where BK,
right.
Dennis Rader, was roaming around. Yeah, it has to have an effect. It, like you said, you still check the doors. Once I read Helter Skelter, I grew up in the South. We never had keys to the house. We never
yeah.
locked the house. But once I read Helter Skelter, I started locking everything. You know,
well, the fascinating thing, my family and I talk about this all the time, what the real untold mystery back in Wichita is how many other cases there were that for some reason the police in Wichita say, and I assume they must have some reason to say that Dennis Rader was not responsible for them, but look an awful lot like that. And again, I said, you know, with years of experience, I now realize the odds of things that horrific happening are extremely low, and yet they were happening a lot there, and apparently the Wichita police want me to believe that it was not just this one guy doing it, but a lot of different guys doing it. So either there was something in the water or copycat or he did a lot more shenanigans that they're for some reason not attributing to him. Like, I know way more about that stuff than I wish I did.
Yeah, I always say
I think
statistics are for the masses. For the individual, it's either 0 or 100.
Right.
It either happens
yeah.
or it doesn't.
Well, and as you know, as we've talked about many times here, we don't really know because we have such poor tracking of unidentified remains, missing persons cases, such poor system of death investigation. I mean, I do realize that, you know, no matter what, yes, statistically lower than the sort of rage killing that goes inside families and so on, but I don't think we know the true statistics of any of this because we just
right.
don't have a good system for detecting them.
Right.
Well, Alifar, somewhere along the line, the little girl who grew up in Kansas with BTK, you decided that that you were going to pursue a legal career. What? Why did you decide that, and how did that come about?
Yeah, I wish I had a better answer for this, but I think like a lot, I hate to say it, like a lot of lawyers, it was, I punted. Like, I got out of college, I wasn't entirely sure what I wanted to do. I still had lots and lots of dreams, and, you know, you can't pursue them all. And I happened to be very good at analytical reasoning, and so I thought I could get into a good law school, and I thought that left a lot of doors open for me. So when I started law school, I thought, well, I could either go, you know, save the world and work for the Southern Poverty Law School Law Center with Morris Dees, or I could go into entertainment law and represent people who are actors and eat at the Ivy every day, or I could be a prosecutor, or I could go into tax law because I always liked tax and math. And it really, it's a totally uninteresting answer, but I think it really is one of the ways that makes, you know, as a law professor, I always tell students, like, if you're interested in law, you will find your path. If you're not interested in law and you know nothing about the practice of law, you shouldn't go. But I knew a lot about what being a lawyer entailed. I knew there were a lot of options. I hadn't really made up my mind about where that would lead me. But interestingly, criminal law wasn't particularly on my mind. It wasn't until I got into law school, and even out of law school, I was still planning to be a commercial litigator, and I clerked for a federal judge, and I found myself really drawn to the criminal cases, and I kind of turned, you know, 45 degrees a little bit and turned down my law firm job that I was supposed to take. They're still mad at me for it, and went to the DA's office in Portland instead. And you know, still constantly, I say all crime all the time. It's I'm kind of surrounded by crime, crime stories at least. You know, lawyers are, it's not, if people think of it as being kind of a technocrat or being very, you know, everybody knows what the stereotypes of lawyers are, but you really do get immersed in people's problems. Like, you get to know people's families, or you represent a defendant whose life is on the line, or even if it's just money at stake, people care about their money. So it's important work, and I'm still very passionate about it. So, but I went into it just sort of winging it. It seemed better than being a barista.
Well, you did indeed decide to join the prosecutor's office in Portland, Oregon. I know you spent about 5 years there. And can you tell us what that was like being a prosecutor there in I think, one of America's great cities? I love Portland. And were there any particular cases that you were involved in there that had an effect on you, or that were memorable, that affected you down the road, or that were interesting?
Yeah. I would say, more than any one case, it was the world of it. Like, it became it's this very unique environment, and I'm sure the Portland DA's office is probably different from DA's offices in other cities, but I think each place has its own special atmosphere, and you're young. I mean, I was 25. Yeah, I think I was probably 25 years old, and you're running around with cases and handling witnesses and talking to judges. You know, I mean, it's kind of a crazy way to jump in. And so that was exciting. In terms of the cases, I hate to go back to serial killers again. There's probably a reason I go to that well sometimes in fiction. But I worked on two different serial killer cases there. Again, I don't, maybe these people are following me. I'm not sure. But, one of the most interesting cases was, you know, I was a relatively young lawyer, and I had a case where the entirety of the police report, literally the entirety of the police report, was A1, you know, what they use for, like, the arrestee one, threw an onion at his sister's head, and it exploded. period.
that's a dangerous pronoun reference there.
And Portland,
the
Portland
onion
like,
or the head.
That's a great opening line for a novel, though.
That was the entirety of the police report. And you guys know enough about law enforcement, you probably know why. Portland had a mandatory arrest system for domestic violence cases, and the definition of domestic violence included any two cohabitating adults. So it was his 18-year-old sister, and this guy was, I don't know, 24 or something like that, and he had thrown an onion at his sister, and it exploded, in the words of the police report. And the family called the police, and they said, this guy's, you know, this son of ours is completely out of control. He's very violent. He just assaulted his sister, and under mandatory arrest laws, he had to go. But they would write those one-sentence police reports as a way to document the probable cause to arrest, but kind of signal to the DA's office, like, this is a nothing case, you shouldn't do anything with it. And yet, the family was very persistent, saying, he's really violent, the legal system needs to intervene, somebody should be watching him, he should be on probation. And our office went, this was before I even got the case, somebody else issued it as an assault. And when I got it, no disrespect to my brother, my first instinct was like, oh, my brother did so many worse things to me to throw an onion at me. and so I would make fun of this case. I hate to say it. I would make fun of it, and I would call it the exploding onion case. But to my surprise, the defense attorney called me. I assumed I was going to have to go to trial where the sister was going to be like, my brother threw an onion at me, and it was just going to be horrible. And to my surprise, the guy pled guilty to assault and took probation, I think, and anger management counseling or something like that. And I never thought of it again until a couple of years passes, and I get a phone call from, like, the second guy in charge, like the big, you know, first assistant or something, saying, you know, do you remember this guy named Sebastian Shaw? And I remember the name because it's kind of a weird name. And I'm like, that's the exploding onion case. And he's like, I don't know what you're talking about. So I told him what I was talking about. And what had happened was that same guy had gotten pulled over in a traffic stop, and the police officer got a weird vibe off of him, asked for consent to search a car, popped the trunk, and there's a gym bag that had burglary tools, a ski mask, gloves, a knife, zip ties, and condoms. So it was basically a rape kit. And the cop is like, okay, I'm not going to just ignore this. And the whole question is, what do you do with a creepy guy who's running around with that assortment of legal but disturbing things all in the same gym bag? And they had continued to follow him. I think they called me to say, what do you know about it? And I said, and he threw an onion to his sister, and the family insisted that he was super creepy. And so they followed him for a while, and luckily he smoked, and they picked up a discarded cigarette butt, and ran it through the DNA databank. And it turned out that he had killed multiple people and raped multiple people. And it all came out of, I mean, it's just the most, I think it goes back to those things that these people are walking among us, and I think it goes back to what Jan said, that there's really no way of knowing the statistics, and there's no way to find the patterns, because no one knew this guy was doing that. Nobody knew any of it. And what I always found so interesting that is that somehow his family knew. You know, it wasn't about the onion, obviously. It was they knew that someone in their family was a monster, basically. And I love that. There's so much about that case that interests me. It's the family dynamic. It's the fact that a police officer kind of got a bad vibe off of him. I love the procedural parts of it. And so that's probably my favorite case. The exploding onion case.
Yeah.
I tell my students I think I can teach all of criminal procedure through the lens of the exploding onion case.
Probably. Yeah, I can see that. Well, that is that kind of fascinating thing, I think, also in that when you start looking at that world and being in that world, you're all the sort of any idea you had about the nice, safe world around you, I'm sure, shifts a bit as well. You look at people who throw onions differently anyway.
Yeah, and it's not even, I mean, that's like a huge that's an amazing case. I mean, that's the kind of case you couldn't even write a book about because nobody would believe you. But it was also just these very small cases. I still remember like some little kids who, you know, some guy had flashed them and kind of tried to grab them. You couldn't prove the grabbing enough to make it a kidnapping or anything like that. So it was basically just a misdemeanor exposure. By the way, exposing yourself to children, the idea that that is a misdemeanor, it just makes me insane. But that's a whole other topic. Mm. I used to take a lot of those cases because it's little kids having to testify and it's just for a misdemeanor. It's just like, this is insane. But those were cases that the system didn't really care about at all. But you know, the kids' parents were always so appreciative that, like, I would bring the kids in early and show them the courtroom and get it so that they weren't afraid. And, I mean, those were the kinds of things where you start to think, like, it does matter that I'm here as opposed to, you know, maybe somebody else. So
what did you love most about being a prosecutor? And I guess at the same time, what did you love least?
Yeah, I guess in terms of most, I guess it's kind of what I was talking about, where it's kind of little cases that the really big ones are going to be the ones they find career people who really know what they're doing, and you know, any office is for the most part hopefully not going to screw up a big major case. But it's actually the little ones where it's almost like it's not customer service, because obviously you represent the public, you don't represent individual victims, but you know, there were moments where you knew that some normal person, whether it's a victim or just a witness, is getting thrown into a system that can be scary to people who don't understand it. And when they were appreciative that they kind of landed in the hands of a lawyer who was willing to make it manageable and accessible, I think, and appreciated that, it was, I think those were probably my happiest moments. You know, the part I didn't like is you only have so much control and you only have, you know, so much power, obviously, and, you know, you can't make it so that some guy who's basically a sex offender but only got caught exposing himself, only, quote-unquote, exposing himself to children,
mm-hmm.
you can't change the fact that he's going to get a shorter sentence than somebody who had a little tiny bit of cocaine. You can't change the fundamentals, the building blocks of the system, and that can be pretty frustrating. And then also, as somebody who's obsessed with time, as you guys know, you already know that from the scheduling of the interview, the hurrying up, you know, that you're like in a frenzy, like the judge is like, get up here right now, and like you're trying to rope your witnesses together and get your cop there and get ready, and you run up there and no one's there, and you're just sitting there for an hour and a half. So that we used to call it hurry up and wait, or judicial time, you know, court time.
So you bring up some interesting things for a lot of us who don't have law degrees, haven't practiced law, haven't been really in that world. What are some of the ways in which the real life of a prosecutor differs from what we might have seen in books and on the screen, either small or large?
Yeah, I would say maybe the biggest misunderstanding is I think most lay people think that, particularly prosecutors, maybe not all lawyers, but prosecutors, they think that they're always in court and that they're always doing trials. You know, I think a lot of people think the system is just like Law and Order, where the police, you know, catch their guy, and then in the second half hour of the show, you know, a few days later, right, a few days later, or maybe, you know, a few weeks later, everybody goes to the courtroom and they have a trial, that's what happens. And I'm surprised, like, people in my family who have two different prosecutors in our family, and the other day I was having a conversation with a family member going, I can't wait for this to go to trial. I'm like, it's not going to trial. Like, nothing goes to trial. I averaged maybe a trial a month when I was in a trial unit, and I've been told by New York prosecutors that that's a ton, that I had way more trial experience than they got. Federal prosecutors go to trial once a year. Most cases do not go to trial. So then you've got to ask, okay, so what is everybody doing? You're issuing cases, you're arguing motions to suppress, you're arguing about the evidence, you're arguing about the charging, and you're pleading stuff out. And pleading stuff out is so much discretion. And it, I do this thing with my students where I have them do a mock plea, and I give them all, which that's not even going to be the real world. I give them all a contained set of facts. I don't even, you know, have them go out and dig around and find extra facts. I give them a contained set of facts and give them a sentencing range, which is not always the case, and tell them to go do a mock plea, and then they come in, and they're just all over the place. And they kind of think it's funny until I point out that, like, those are going to be real people. Like, that guy, Bob Smith, is going to have agreed to take a sentence of 7 years, and he's going to come into court and enter his plea, and the guy next to him is going to be doing 10 months on a misdemeanor. And they're like, oh, yeah, that kind of blows. And I'm laughing about it just because it's sort of absurd, but I don't think most people understand that it's not just, I mean, we know, I think anyone who's paying attention knows that there are certain pressures on the system that give you advantages or disadvantages. So if you have a really good lawyer or you're wealthy or you're white, you know, if you're someone of privilege, you're going to do better in the system. But whose desk it lands on, like which prosecutor gets that case and whether they care about it or not or how they see it or if they've got a bone to pick with you or whether they see you as sympathetic has more impact than what judge you get, what jury you get. It's an amazing amount of power. And, if I could do one thing for prosecutors, it would be to get them to realize that is just – it's unreviewable, limitless power about how you negotiate your pleas. It's pretty weighty stuff. So.
Well, after your years in the prosecutor's office there in Portland, you kind of followed two parallel paths after that. One is you wrote your excellent first novel, Judgment Calls, which
Jan Burke blurbed.
Yes, she did.
Happily.
Which introduced us to Deputy DA Samantha Kincaid, who, shock of all shocks, is the prosecutor in Portland. As if that wasn't enough, being the quintessential underachiever, you also decided to relocate to New York, and you began teaching criminal law at Hofstra University. What led you... First of all, I mean, to the academia world. Why did you take that route, and what attracted you to that?
It was a little bit roundabout. I had thought about going the academic route during law school. You know, when I had all my maybe I'll sit at the Ivy and negotiate deals all day, or maybe I'll do this, and maybe I'll. I mean, what's attractive about academia, and I still love it. Is I mean, it really is one of the last. Places where it's pure intellectual freedom. Someone pays you to explore ideas and to do so seriously and then to inspire the next generation of student, which in my case happens to be future lawyers. So it was an attractive job, but I kind of went about it in a weird way. I was at the DA's office, and speaking of things people don't know that are counterintuitive, the longer you practice law, the harder it is to get a job teaching law. The idea is you get perverted by legal practice, and you become a practitioner, which is not an academic. So there really is a separate academic track. And I was, I went to the right school, and I had the right clerkship, and I published my law review note, and I published one other thing. So I was kind of on that track. But I was 26 years old and wasn't ready to, like, jump into the tenured law professor pool. And I was interested in criminal law. I'm like, I'm going to go to the DA's office and see how it actually works. And I stayed, frankly, from academic perspective, too long, which was only 5 years, believe it or not. I was like an old lady by the time I went on the teaching market. So I stayed at the DA's office because I found it really interesting. And then when I moved to New York, I had this summer off. And how many times do you get a whole summer off with literally nothing to do? So I decided I had always wanted to write a book, and I had always wanted to be decent at golf. So I got myself a package of golf lessons, and I got myself a computer. This was before everybody had a computer. I went and bought like a $200 crappy computer and a desk at Costco and set up my little writing corner. And I'm like, I'm going to start that book I've always wanted to write. I'm going to learn how to swing a golf club. I still do both. but I wrote, you know, it's a funny thing. I wrote about maybe 150 or 200 pages that summer. And then I started working, and so I wasn't working on it. I wasn't writing, you know, I'd take it out and I'd write a few pages here and there, but I wasn't being serious about it. And Jan's agent, Phil Spitzer, is my father's agent. And when I moved to New York, he started asking me out, you know, to parties and, you know, hanging out and that kind of thing. And I made the mistake, or maybe it was a brilliant move. I mentioned to him that I was working on something, and he just wouldn't leave me alone. He's like, "Where's the book? Where's the book?" I'm like, "Oh, I'm not going to finish that book. I'm not going to finish that book. Like, I don't know how. I don't know what I'm doing." And he had a book party for Michael Connelly. Gianna, have I told you this story?
Maybe
I haven't told you this story. So Phil Spitzer had a party, like a book party for Michael Connelly. And Phil, being Phil, told Michael Connelly, like, "Oh, Alifair," because I'm like a stalker of my, or I was at the time, like, I was one of those people who'd show up at Michael Connelly's events and be like, "Can you sign my book?" And there I was at Phil's house, and he's like, "Don't you live in Portland? Don't I see you at Powell's? Aren't you a DA?" And like, it was like, and he didn't know I was, you know, this Burke connection, you know, this Spitzer connection. So Phil was like, "Oh, yeah, she was in the DA's office in Portland, and she used to stalk you at Powell's, but, you know, now she lives here, and she's related to one of my clients," and blah, blah, blah. So Phil goes and tells Michael Connelly, who's, like, my favorite writer, other than Jan, I mean, that I was working on this book. And Michael Connelly, being the nice person he is, even though I'm sure he was exhausted at the end of this book party, came and found me, and he's like, "Phil said that you wrote, like, you have a book?" And I'm like, "I don't have a book." And, and he's like, "Well, he says you have a book." I'm like, "No, I have, like, part of a book, and now I have a job, and I can't work on it anymore." And he's like, "You gave yourself a summer to write a book." I'm like, "I know. I don't know what I was thinking. It's not going to get done." He goes, "Well, how much did you get done?" I think he expected me to say, like, 10 pages. And I said, "Well, like, 200 pages. And he's like, "You have 200 pages? I'm like, "Yeah, I have 200 pages. And he goes, "Well, why can't you finish it?" And I go, "It's just a mess. Like, I haven't looked at it for months. I can't even remember what's going on." And he goes, "Do you have an outline?" I'm like, "No." He goes, "Do you know who did it?" And I'm like, "Well, yeah, I know who did it." He goes, "You know why they did it?" I'm like, "Yeah, I know why they did it." And he like waves over these other writers, and they just start mocking me, basically, that I had 200 pages. I knew who did it and why, and I'm like, "I can't finish it." And they're like, "Oh, my God, that's the fun part." They're all like, "Just give it to me. I'll finish it. Like, give it to me." So they basically mocked me, and he signed his book for me that night. "I can't wait to read your book." And it really was like, "I can't show up to another reading of his until I finish this, you know, motherfucking book." So I went back, and once classes were over, I got my manuscript back out, and he had given me, like, you know, 5 minutes of advice, basically, like, "Go back and look at what you did and see where the clues are and figure out how you're going to finish it." And I finished it in a month and a half or 2 months or something like that. I mean, I worked on it constantly, but it became my passion project. So I finished it that summer, and that was Judgment Call. So, and again, kind of being accidental about how I finished this book, I thought it would be my one book that I would put in my law school office and say, you know, "Professor Burke wrote a book." And, you know, this genre world being what it is, the editors who wanted it were like, "Oh, and this is a series, right?" I'm like, "Yeah, uh-huh, yes, it is." They're like, "You have lots of other ideas."
You'd be surprised how often that happens.
Right. "You have lots of other ideas for books, right?" I'm like, "Oh, millions of ideas." "And an ability to write on a schedule. Yes, I can do that." So I kind of stumbled into two really great jobs. So I feel extremely lucky.
Well, I mean, you did. I mean, you, as I mentioned, you gave us Samantha Kincaid, and you also created the wonderful character, the NYPD detective, Ellie Hatcher. So you've written about both the DA and the cop on the street type of fiction. When you read crime fiction, as I know you do, are there things that you see repetitively where people write about homicide detectives and DAs and the legal system that absolutely drive you up the wall?
Well, I think it was the stuff that drove me up the wall that initially made me one of those annoying lawyers who's like, "I'm going to write a book," because, you know, I love the genre. And then I would see these stupid mistakes, you know, But now I'm the kind of person, like, the stupid mistakes are where you think you know, and so you don't know to look it up.
Right.
Like, my whole life, I said the ugliest car in the world was a GMC Pacer. My whole life I've said that. It's an AMC Pacer, so I don't know to look that up. My whole life I've been saying GMC Pacer, and so it goes into print. No copy editor went and looked that up either. So it's the stuff you don't know to look up that winds up in there. So the kind, just like a car person would look at my mistake of GMC Pacer and be like, oh, you're so stupid. I see these legal things, and I'm like, oh, you're so stupid. But it's because you didn't know to ask. So I think the main mistake, I think, is people think they know, and I think part of it is from watching TV or something like that. So the less detail you use, the less likely it is you're going to make a mistake. It's when people are extremely specific, like saying, like, you can't go in there, you don't have a search warrant. Most of the time you don't need a search warrant. There's 8 million exceptions. Not 8 million, but there's like 17 exceptions. So,
yeah.
And it's funny enough, they seem to always apply. So if people avoid the jargon, if they actually just don't, if you don't know it, just don't go there, or just always ask to be safe. It's when people kind of think they know, because, and you see that all the time. You see it on CNN.com, you know, every legal story, there are people who jump into the comments like, that was blatantly illegal, they can't do that. It's like, yeah, you don't know what you're talking about. So it's more learning when to ask, right? It's like, just don't assume that you know, because I think people don't even know the difference between federal prosecutors and state prosecutors, and it's when you get detailed like that that you're more likely to run into stuff. But, you know, it'll be a few legal geeks that are offended by it, I guess, and it shouldn't affect the story. But, yeah, I mean, I'll admit that before I started writing and started making mistakes like GMC Pacer, I would get annoyed when people made those legal mistakes.
And it's not a new concept. I mean, even back, you know, as far as the ancient Greeks, they said Socrates is the smartest man on earth because he knew what he didn't know.
Right.
And I think that's important. You got to know what you don't know, so
yeah,
you'll go ask.
I made some really stupid mistake recently, and it's the nature of memory. It was a Harry Met Sally concept. I've seen that movie probably 18 times or something, and I made some reference to when Harry met Sally about where they had met or where they had driven from, something like that. And again, like, I've seen it so many times it didn't dawn on me to double check my memory. And luckily, you know, one of the early readers in-house had seen When Harry Met Sally even more than I had. Like, actually, they drove from this place and this place, not this place and this place. So, you know, there's things in your head that you really think you know and you don't. So,
well, I think also just beyond writers, the general public sometimes has, again, probably because the general public watches more law on Law and Order, where they make up law, than they do watching, say, a channel where there's an actual trial in progress, and what you realize is the thing gets interrupted every few minutes by someone making a motion or whatever, or objecting.
Right.
But you've written, one of the pieces I've recently seen up on the web is something that you wrote about the effect that jury instructions may have had on the Zimmerman case in Florida. And it seemed to me, as I was reading it, I thought, this is one of those areas of many areas of confusion for the public that seems really, you know, the law is a law. It's like you're playing a sport or something where there's
right,
a rule book, and everybody comes onto the field, and the rules are just the same no matter what, and nobody has any kind of ability to, you know, push the game in one way or another because we all agree on the rule book. Well, you know, it's not that there isn't law, but
mm-hmm,
but there's some leeway in there. And so tell us more about how jury instructions can change the outcome of a trial.
My students get so sick and tired of me constantly. During first-year criminal law, I'm always they sit there and go straight to the facts, and I'm like, nope. No facts, jury instructions, because the typical division of labor in a jury trial is that the judge is supposed to decide issues of law and the jury decides questions of fact. But when it comes to the ultimate question, is someone guilty or not, They can't resolve the questions of fact without doing it through the lens of the law, right? So you can't decide whether someone's guilty of murder or manslaughter without knowing the definitions of murder and manslaughter. And that's where the role of jury instructions come in. The jury only knows the law the way it's described to them by the judge. And there's different ways judges can do that, because we don't just send the jury to the law library and say, look up all the statutes and look up all the cases interpreting those statutes. The judge is supposed to do that in plain language. So, you know, at the very least, the jury instructions will kind of mirror the language of a statute and say, for example, that, you know, murder includes purposeful homicides and, you know, certain kinds of extreme indifference to human life kinds of homicides, and manslaughters are more like accidental homicides, things like that. But particularly with things like defenses, like self-defense, the law of self-defense is so complicated in terms of who has the burden of proof, reasonable belief of a fear, what kind of fear, like is the level of aggression high enough to warrant using deadly force. And then the thing I wrote about with the Zimmerman case, in the killing of Trayvon Martin, was there's an exception to self-defense if someone's the initial aggressor. So basically, I can't sit there and, like, poke you constantly, Dan, and then when you slap me, claim assault, right? So I can't sit there and slap you, and when you slap me back, say, oh, I'm the victim. And if you couple that with you're allowed to use defensive force, you're allowed to make a mistake, basically. So if you pull out what looks to be a real gun and jump out at me in the dark and say I'm going to shoot you, and I reasonably believe that you're going to do that, I'm justified in using force against you, even if, you know, it was a dare on your part. You know, you're allowed to make a mistake as long as it's a reasonable mistake. So when you put all of that together, you have these scenarios where, let's say, for example, that Zimmerman was doing something that perhaps was lawful, like following Trayvon Martin. And if Trayvon Martin reasonably believed that to be a threat to him and did something aggressive to defend himself from that, and it spiraled from there, it becomes this question of who's the initial aggressor. And the jury instructions never even explained that. And when you know, if you really want to geek out on this, you can go and watch the video of the jury instruction litigation. And you could tell that the judge was just tired, and they were rushing through the jury instructions, and they had already, you know, litigated several other matters about the instructions, and you could tell, you can tell that the defense attorneys were surprised when they won, that there was, because they were prepared to litigate what, how are you going to word the initial aggressor exception. And instead, she was like, we're not going to give an initial aggressor instruction, move on. And everybody was just kind of like, what? Seriously? Mm-hmm. We're not going to have that? And then they just kind of plowed through it. So if you listen to the jurors when they talk about it afterwards, because, again, you can't blame the jury. I mean, I know a lot of people did, and my whole thing in that piece was to say you can't really blame the jury, because the jury's job is to apply the law as they are taught it by the court. And
I may have been lost here.
I'm here.
Okay. do we lose Alifair, or
is it just maybe
the two of us?
So.
I'm gonna assume that the two of us are still on. So while we're waiting for Alifair to get reconnected, I'm gonna just. I'm sure Doug, you feel the same way. She is a wonderful writer. I'm so glad. Philip persisted with her because her books are great. I think she's got 9 out now, and has the newest is All Day and a Night, which features Ellie Hatcher. She has a homicide investigator in New York City. And I was also thinking, you know, and I think since we don't have any law experience, Doug and I can talk to you about writing. And one of the things that she mentioned that is really important, really, really important, is interruption is deadly. Avoid it as much as you can while you're writing, because you get into that fictional world and you get going. And then if you get out of it, and sometimes you can't help it, sometimes real life just, you know, makes you stop working on a manuscript. But any manuscript's going to look like nonsense when you go back to it, because you sort of, you know, you're not yet in the point where you should be in editorial mode with it. You should just be inventing.
Exactly, and it breaks that rhythm, it breaks that continuity, and I find that when that happens, you know, I'll have, you know, 150 pages written, and then something will happen, and you won't be able to work on it for about a month. Something else comes up. I find I really have to go back and read those 150 mm-hmm. pages to kind of get back in the rhythm of the run, as it were. Just skimming it doesn't seem to work. You got to really go back and re-immerse yourself in the story and try to resist doing too much editing while you're doing that, because you're still trying to lay out the story. But I find that what you're saying is absolutely true. And once you lose that rhythm, you got to go back and pick it up again.
Right. It's really that whole thing of, you know, that there's every writer has to sort of be in two different modes, and they are really different modes. And one is that playful, imaginative mode that is just making stuff up and and playing and having fun. And if it doesn't make sense, the great thing is you get to revise and go back later and do something with it. But
hey, Doug and Dan,
editorial.
I'm going to cut in here real quick. This is John, your producer,
okay.
Of course. The one thing, Al Affair has not called back in, so we're not sure what happened. I don't know if something happened with her line or whatnot. So we can wait. You guys can keep talking if you want.
Yeah.
But the show's been excellent. So, yeah, whatever you guys want to do.
Well, I know there's thunderstorms in New York.
Yeah,
right.
We can have
outage.
A sing-along. I mean, we can sit here and sing the Flintstones theme, whatever you guys want to do. I mean, this is the great thing about, you know, Crime and Science Radio. You just never know what's going to happen at any given time. Crime's happening
exactly.
All over the place. You know?
Right. Well, and you know, I think some of the other stuff that's come up today, too, is just you don't need to be you may be sitting there thinking after what she's said that if you're not an attorney, you can't write a court scene, and I don't think that's her message. She's not a homicide investigator, but she's writing about one now, and that just has to do with, and it's really the fun parts of it all, is you just have to be willing to want to know about these things.
Exactly.
And, yeah.
And I always say everybody's smart in something and stupid in something. And so if you're smart in something, you know it, and you can help other people. And if you're stupid in something, stop and ask questions. It never hurts. I always tell people there are no stupid questions. There's only stupid answers. So don't be afraid to ask.
Yeah. Well, and I think both Doug and I have had, you know, aspects of our career that, you know, like Blanche and A Streetcar Named Desire, we depended on the kindness of strangers.
Exactly.
And, you know, it's amazing. I think new writers often feel that experts will not talk to them. And there is... a respect you should have toward any other person who's going to offer you their expertise, and respect their time, and not say, ask them some question that you could have learned by Googling something.
Yeah, exactly.
Or reading a book. But once you've prepared, people love to talk about their work, and it's probably easier than you think it is. You know, to approach someone and say, you know, I'm writing, and this is what I've got so far. You know, can you tell me more about this or talk to me about that? I don't know about you, but I have rarely had somebody turn me down flat, and sometimes I got those folks to come around.
Exactly. No, and I think for writers out there, never, and I think Alifar pointed this out, never be afraid to ask questions. Never underestimate the power of the word writer. Don't say reporter, they'll run away. But if you say writer, people do want to talk about what they know, and they will bend over backwards to help you. That's always been my situation. I've never had anybody say, I don't want to talk about that, or I don't have the time to do that. They seem to always find the time for writers. I think it's because everybody actually wants to be a writer. And there's something mystical about it. It's actually hard work, but there's something mystical about it. And so people want to be part of that, and they want to tell what they know. And our whole radio program, I think, is exactly that. We get people in here who are experts, and they want to talk about what they know, and they want to share their knowledge with people. And that's one of the things I love about this whole program and the way it's gone since its inception.
Right. I agree. It's part of the fun of it is giving people new things to look at and think about, new areas of expertise that can help make a book a little more fun for you, and ideally fun for the reader as well. In my first book, here's a story I don't think I've ever told you, Doug. I for some odd reason, I remember now, I had to go out to Yuma, Arizona because of, I won't give the book away, but because of a clue that actually literally had to be based in that kind of geographical area. I had some choices, and the closest choice was Yuma, Arizona. So the IRS has never, ever questioned my write-off. if I'd said that I had to go to Paris, it would have been different. But I said I had to go to Yuma, Arizona. And so I wanted to know what the law enforcement setup was there, which was good because it's a sheriff base, and I would have had a Yuma Police Department because I didn't know any better at the time. And so we eventually, this is pre-GPS, days, you didn't have a GPS in most of your rental cars. We were just working off of an auto club trip tick, and my sister was with me, and we're circling the Yuma, Arizona Sheriff's Department. And eventually, it's because I couldn't really figure out where I should be going in to ask the question I had. But eventually, they came out to talk to me because I think they thought we were trying to break somebody. The jail, as it happened, was on the same premises. And I think they thought we were there to help somebody go on the lam. But once he figured out that the two middle-aged ladies in the car were unlikely to be on that kind of errand, the guy in charge happily talked to us and was very, very forthcoming. But so you may want to not include circling the jail as part of your.
Well, I guess we're running out of our allotted time, and it's unfortunate because we were having so much fun with Alifair.
Hold on.
So anyway, I want to let everybody know that we will have links up to her website and her books and some of the things we've talked about, and she has a new book coming out called All Day and a Night, another Ellie Hatcher story. So look all that stuff up. Buy her books. You will not be disappointed. They're exceptionally well written and researched, and she knows of what she speaks.
Hold on, Doug. Hold that thought. Because Alifair is back. She ran downstairs to make sure that her basement door was all locked and shut. So she's back here. So why don't you go ahead and end it for the last couple of minutes. And here she is, everybody. Alifair Burke is back from the bank. She's back from the basement. Go ahead.
Elvis is in the room.
I think the beep, beep, beep was telling me, stop talking about jury instructions.
Well, welcome back. We were talking about you while you were gone.
Well, can you tell us about All Day and a Night, the new Ellie Hatcher novel?
I can. It's my 10th book and my 5th book in the Ellie Hatcher series, and it's an odd blend of it's half police procedural and half kind of courtroom thriller, although I hate that word because it's sort of an oxymoron, but it's a wrongful conviction case. So unfortunately, we're seeing a lot of these where we're now over 300 exoneration cases.
Okay.
And Ellie Hatcher is assigned to work it on behalf of the DA's office, and then the other half of the story is told by a killer's defense attorney named Carrie Blank. So it's kind of fun to tell the story of an investigation from two different sides.
And when's it going to be available?
It's out.
Oh, it is. Okay,
yeah,
good.
It came out 2 weeks ago.
Oh, perfect. Congratulations. We will look for
great.
It.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
So do you have any... Oh, go ahead, Dick.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, well, it sounds like we're running out of time, but any quick recommendations for people that are going to be writing about police procedure or legal matters? Any quick advice for them?
Call law schools. You know, ask about
that's
my
great
whole thing.
Advice.
Lawyers love, as you learned, to help. So if you, you know, ask people, it's kind of what we were talking about of, you know, don't feel like you have to figure it out on your own. There's somebody who probably knows the answer right off the top of their head.
Excellent.
That's great. Well, thank you so much for joining us. Everyone, visit our website, crimeandscienceradio.com. We'll have links up there for more information about Alifair and her books. Links for you to pursue what we've talked about further, everything except the Yuma Sheriff's Department. That's strictly offline. But we're so glad you could join us, Alifair. Thanks for being here with us.
Absolutely.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
See you soon.
Bye-bye.